United States against Davis is the next case on for argument. Mr. Beal.
May it please the court, the heart of Defendant Davis's argument is that the government's informant, Benjamin Haro, intentionally brought about the prosecution of the two black defendants in this case, and he intentionally did not set up other drug dealers of other races. He may have assisted with other cases. He claims he tried to set up other dealers, but his efforts were so transparently phony they cannot fairly be called genuine. There were other dealers that he had equally or closer relationships with than with these two defendants, and yet he chose not to make any genuine effort to set them up. The most striking instance of that was the 6 to 8 phone calls, controlled phone calls he made with government agents, where he acknowledged he made one call, there was no answer, and they abandoned the enterprise. And I would submit that DEA deserves more credit than that, that if they really wanted to pursue other dealers, they would make a much more substantial effort than they in fact did. So what we have here is a situation where we have both a discriminatory effect that other drug dealers were not set up, and we have a discriminatory or selective intention, which is that Haro had the intention of only setting up these two and not his Hispanic buddies. And we submit that that meets the criteria of Barlow and the other cases cited of the selective prosecution under the case law. So we would ask this court.
What's your response to the government's argument that this was all forfeited because a proper motion wasn't made? This is a motion to dismiss the indictment, and such motions have to be made before trial.
Well, Your Honor, we would respond that they have to be made before trial unless there's good cause.
Unless the district judge finds that there was good cause and no such finding was made.
That's true that no such finding was made. We submit that there was, in fact, good cause, which is that the defense did not have the evidence in hand until the trial was concluded, and then put the evidence forth in the sentencing hearing and asked the judge to make an appropriate finding at that time, and that when the judge said that there was no evidence in the record, that he was incorrect, that there is in fact evidence in the record, in fact sufficient evidence in the record to support the defendant's position, and this court should therefore remand the sentencing in the case to Judge Cannelli so that he can make a proper finding and take a proper action in accordingly. The court has no further questions. I have reserved the balance of my time.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Beal. Mr. Peters.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Tom Peters on behalf of the defendant, Kelvin Kuykendall. With respect to his case, the court should reverse and remand because there was a highly prejudicial confrontation clause violation that occurred when excerpts of Ms. Davis's testimony were read into the record as part of Mr. Kuykendall's trial. As the court knows, their cases were severed at the beginning of what was supposed to be a joint trial because Judge Cannelli properly found that there were going to be antagonistic defenses. Having concluded that, nonetheless, when it came time for Mr. Kuykendall's trial, where the primary issue in the case was who was the male voice on the phone, an excerpt, and albeit a small excerpt, of Ms. Davis's testimony was read into the record. Mr. Kuykendall's attorney obviously had no opportunity to confront or cross-examine her with respect to those issues that were brought out during that excerpt reading. And the excerpt reading was crucial to the government's case because it established that Mr. Kuykendall was residing at the address from which and to which the phone calls were made involving the government's confidential informant. The government, with respect to that issue, did not have very compelling evidence. And in fact, the jury found, or apparently, I mean, one never knows precisely what's on the jury's mind, but there is, for example, a note from the jury asking specifically for a review or an opportunity to read the transcript of Ms. Davis's testimony. That testimony, it seems to us, was crucial to the government's case. It became an important factor in the jury's deliberations, and Mr. Kuykendall was never had the opportunity to confront and cross-examine Ms. Davis about it. Now, the government, as I understand it, is claiming, well, it's a relatively short matter. You know, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. Let's just let it go by the board. But the fact of the matter is that the government is also claiming that all of Ms. Davis's testimony in her case was for the most part, it was concocted, it was false, and it was perjurious. So on the one hand, they're saying in Ms. Davis's case, you should convict her because she's not telling the truth about this story of entrapment. But in Mr. Kuykendall's case, they're turning around and say, well, there's sufficient indicia of trustworthiness that we can allow in this statement from Ms. Davis's testimony. It seems to us that those positions are inconsistent with each other, and that given the fact that this was the principal issue in Mr. Kuykendall's case, after all, they really had very little other evidence linking him to this phone call. There were some voice identifications by other people, but they were hardly the kind that would be compelling evidence to a jury. I mean, the length of their conversation was probably less than what I have already said to the court, and it would be very difficult, I suggest, for any member of the court to subsequently identify my voice a year or 2 years later, having spoken to you as much as I just have. The testimony from the government's other witnesses in Mr. Kuykendall's case was far from compelling. The jury's note suggests that Ms. Davis's excerpts played a role, a significant role, in their determination, and Mr. Kuykendall was not given the opportunity to confront and cross-examine the witness with respect to those issues. And for those reasons, we respectfully request that the court reverse and remand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Peters. Mr. Cullen.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, counsel. The government submits that, as to Defendant Davis, the court should affirm both the conviction as well as the sentence. As far as the conviction, as Judge Easterbrook, you noted, the defendant waived that issue, or at the very least forfeited that issue, by not raising it in a pretrial motion. Rule 12 is very clear that anything that attacks the institution or the prosecution itself must be raised before trial. A claim of selective prosecution attacks the institution or the prosecution itself and therefore must be raised pretrial. Since it was not, it was waived. As far as the sentence of Defendant Davis, there is no jurisdiction to review that. Judge Kennelly acknowledged his authority to depart if he saw fit, but chose not to. And because of that, there is no jurisdiction to review that decision. As to Defendant Kuykendall, I must take issue with the argument that the admission of 14 lines of Defendant Davis's testimony was somehow crucial to the government's case. I think it was anything but.
So why did the prosecution put it in?
Well, Judge,
just to make sure that the defendant wouldn't be able to file an Anders brief?
Well, Judge, as I'm sure you know, when you're prosecuting a trial, you are looking at all the available evidence you have and seeking to admit as much evidence as is necessary to secure a conviction. And you know, when you review the record afterwards, you can see that there was ample, in fact, strong evidence that it was Defendant Kuykendall's voice on that phone, and that the admission of those 14 lines, in hindsight, might not have been necessary. The three separate witnesses who identified Defendant Kuykendall's voice on the phone did so on the basis of voice identification. And there was some comment as to the brevity of the contact between the witness and Defendant Kuykendall. One of the witnesses who offered the voice identification testimony was Harrell, the confidential informant. And the confidential informant described multiple face-to-face meetings with Defendant Kuykendall where they discussed over 200 kilograms of cocaine. I would suggest that ample contact for that, an ample basis for that witness to offer voice identification testimony. The other voice, beyond those three witnesses, is the defendant's own voice. In one of the conversations, the defendant, Kuykendall, identified himself as Coco's husband. And there was other evidence in the case which showed Nicole Davis was known as Coco Davis. There was a marriage certificate admitted in the case showing that Coco Davis was married to Calvin Kuykendall. So when it became the question of who is this person identifying himself as Coco's husband, there was no question that it was Defendant Kuykendall. For those reasons, if there's no questions from the court, the government would stand on its brief. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Beal, you reserve some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. Just very briefly, I would just like to note that the defense contends that as far as the sentence goes, that the court, under 3742, the court does now have the authority to review the district court for clearly erroneous findings of fact. And if, in fact, the court finds clearly erroneous findings of fact that would then result in an error of law, the court has jurisdiction to hear the appeal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And Mr. Peters, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. The case is taken under advisement. Before hearing